This talk has been brought to you by the Center for Philosophical Research, Warsaw, Poland. Check our webpage at www.obf.edu.pl.
Kazimierz Naturalist Workshop, 2008. Susan Hock, Belief in Naturalism.
Partisanship is treason in philosophy. I don't believe in a naturalistic theory because of partisanship with naturalism. I think you have to find the right theory and then figure out whether it's naturalistic or not. Okay. So please interpret my title as not being an expression of faith in naturalism, but as an exploration of the nature of belief and the place of the concept of belief in a modestly naturalized epistemology. Like Peter Jarlsfors, I'm going to start by recalling some earlier things that I've said and then proceed to try to apply them to some new questions. I'm increasingly struck by how much like doing a crossword my manner of working actually is. And I'm sort of going back to somewhere, I've got a lot of stuff penciled in and seeing if I can't make it ink by there. So, first thing I think is worth mentioning, I think by the end of this conference I'm going to be saying, somebody, please God, don't let it be me, is going to have to try to figure out the multiple meanings of the word naturalism, which we have heard many. I also want to draw to your attention the fact that the word is used of a whole bunch of different things. I'm sure my list is not complete, but there's literary and artistic naturalism, there's philosophical naturalism, and philosophical naturalism turns up in metaphysics and philosophy of science and epistemology and ethics and so on and so on. As far as I know, the person who went furthest towards exploring what the interrelations of these various sorts of philosophical naturalism might be is Sidney Hook. So I'm sort of honoring him in that nice picture. Anyway, I like philosophers to have faces. It's one of the advantages of this technology, right? Philosophers can have faces. And I guess I'm also trying to make a point with some of my faces. And that is that there seems to be a sort of tendency to think of naturalism as a kind of post-Quaian thing. It's not. There are clearly naturalistic standards in philosophy beyond. So much by way of pure preamble. I thought I should say something about where I've found theories that I guess qualify as naturalist helpful, plausible. First thing on my list, I now find startling. If you'd asked me even 5 years ago, are you ever going to do ethics? I would have said, no way. No way. My view about ethics always was it's way too hard for me, I can't do it. I still remember taking a class on ethics with Philip Foote, and even despair writing her a paper on deontic logic, about which she very kindly said, yes, okay, you should be doing this kind of thing, go on and do that. But of late, I've found myself obliged to think about the relation between legal and ethical values. And there, I find the work that James and Dewey do in ethics, which is best shortly described as kind of fallibilist empiricism of that ethics, extremely helpful. I think it's the only kind of ethical theory that I've found really helpful for understanding what the relation of legal to ethical values is. And I guess it qualifies as naturalistic, at least by contrast with some things. I'm tempted to say right, but I don't know why. Okay. In metaphysics, I found myself saying things which are very reminiscent of Hooke's repudiation of appeal to supernatural entities. And for a reason that might possibly be of interest to some people, and that is that by my lights, I don't think that supernatural explanations are really explanations at all. I'm tempted to say, I'm old enough, I don't care if it sounds naive. It used to be that I did, but I don't care anymore. I want to say now, look, a supernatural entity is not in time and not in space. So, even supposing that it has intentions, I haven't the foggiest idea how it could put those intentions to work in the physical world. And that's why I don't see supernatural explanations as genuine explanation. I guess I'm a sort of naturalist in the philosophy of science, too, in this sense that I think of science as continuous with ordinary empirical inquiry and as using the same sort of aura, hypothetical deductive method in its work, which I think cooks and detectives and historians and investigative journalists also use, but is distinctive in part because of the very special helps to inquiry that scientists have gradually developed over many, many centuries. I like Gustav Berglund's very nice description of this. Science is the long arm of common sense. It comes from a book of Berglund on philosophy of science, most of which I find rather dull. But it's worth reading the book just for this line, which is really very, very good. And this leads me to such thoughts as, you know, what counts as a well-conducted experiment or a well-designed epidemiological study, say, depends in part on what you control for. And what there's a point in controlling for depends on facts about the world, facts which we have to find out about. For example, I suppose if you're doing work in a laboratory that's doing biological stuff, people will frown if you eat your lunch at the bench, because presumably the stuff in your lunch might affect what's going on in the experiment. But nobody's going to say you can't wear shoes when you come into the laboratory because they will interfere. This is in fact empirical information that we have to learn. And when you look at serious epidemiological studies, for example, the questions about what you have to control for are extremely subtle, extremely complicated, and very factual. So I see a sort of scrambling up the chimney process here, which I guess is a form of naturalism. I'm going to talk here about epistemological naturalism, which is actually where I came in. In evidence and inquiry, I distinguished umpty-ump forms of naturalism. Initially there were five, and then they multiplied, and then there. A student of mine has a wonderful word for this. Not ambiguous, very ambiguous. Perfect word. Etymologically a lovable, but who cares? It's too good not to use. In evidence and inquiry, the three ideas that I was playing with most were reformist a posterioris naturalism, reformist scientistic naturalism, and revolutionary scientistic naturalism. I now think of them as the good, the bad, and the ugly. I made the mistake of using this as the title for a paper to be published in Italian, and then discovered that Leone's film in Italian is called The Good, the Ugly, and the Bad. A total passion. Okay. The view I defended in evidence and inquiry of this matter was reformist a posterioris naturalism, which thinks of epistemology as continuous with the sciences. And not as a wholly a priori enterprise. and acknowledges the contributory relevance of results from the scientific commission to a list of a lot of the questions. Contributory relevance was a concept I went to a lot of trouble to figure out. That was the view I defended in Evidence and Inquiry, and I think if I had to do it again, I would do it again. Though, what's the word for you dive and you do a twiddle with pike? Now, there would be twiddles. Reformist scientistic naturalism. Scientistic, of course, is pejorative. It's rude by my lights. If I call something scientistic, it means it gives too much to science. To call it scientistic is not to it's not to praise it, but of course it's also not to give a definite criticism. It's just so far it's just an insult. That looks to the scientist cognitions as if they could answer at least some epistemological questions. There is rhetoric in Alvin Goldman which suggests that this is his view, but so far as I can tell, it at least is not the view which is presented in epistemology and cognition. I think Alvin greatly dislikes my nasty habit of reading indices, as I've done it to him twice. Never to his delight. I noticed reading the index of epistemology and cognition that there is absolutely no reference to any of the apparatus about normal worlds and all that, which is crucial to the first half, which tells me that there's a sort of disconnect between the two parts of the book. I did it to him again more recently by pointing out that there was no reference to evidence anywhere in Knowledge of the Social World, except in the chapter on the law. I wouldn't make things about that either. I'm probably going to stop making indices if I keep reading. And then revolutionary scientific naturalism, which is much more bold even than that, which denies the legitimacy of the traditional epistemological projects, wants them to be abandoned in favor of like natural scientific projects. And this view was defended by one time slice of Stephen Stitch and by the church. It's only that time slice of Stephen Stitch who will be of interest to me this morning. But there is, of course, another who now admits that we do actually believe things, but thinks that it's a kind of superstition to care whether what we believe is true. All three positions can be found in Quine. Moreover, they can be found sometimes in the same sentence or in the same paragraph. I once spent the best part of a year checking. Now, can it be that he's changed his mind over time? No, because they all turn up in the same paper. And the point at which I decided that I was not losing my mind, I was actually right that Quine was being very vigorous, cubed, was actually at the conference in St. Louis in 1988 for Quine's 80th birthday party, where I gave the opening paper and gave an interpretation of epistemology naturalized in terms of the reformist a posterioris naturalism that I thought was true. And to my great delight, Quine said, yeah, that's right, that's what I meant. So I was in heaven for about 12 hours. And then somebody else gave a paper which interpreted Quine more like Goldman's, a kind of reliabilism. And Quine said to that speaker, yeah, that's right, that's what I meant. And my spirits were sinking fast. And on the next day, somebody else gave an interpretation of epistemology naturalized as something like the Churchman's view. And Quine said yet again, yeah, that's right, that's what I meant. And at this point, I decided that my reading was not uncharitable, it was probably correct. Actually, it's very interesting. I'm sure I've done it too. I don't mean to be nasty to Quine. I'm sure I've done it too. It's remarkable how one can fail to see ambiguities in one's own writing or thinking. I offered a diagnosis in Evidence and Inquiry. The diagnosis was that Quine slides from one to another to a third form of epistemological naturalism because of an ambiguity in the use of his word science, which some of the time means our presumed empirical knowledge, and some of the time means the sciences. These are not equivalent, and that the second is much narrower than the first. Why would that give you this particular variability? Well, because initially he shifts from epistemology as part of science, part of our presumed empirical knowledge. It's an empirical theory about us, to epistemology as part of the sciences. And then he finds himself really in acute embarrassment. How is physics going to tell us what constitutes better or worse evidence? In your dreams, physics is going to tell you what makes evidence better or worse. So, having got yourself in that mess, you're tempted to say, well, those questions are misconceived. I'm trying to whistle through these because I want to get to them. But this is the pipe that I wish I had introduced. I should have said, if I wrote it now, I would say much more clearly. I did say, look, there's a question about quantifiers. Some traditional questions, all traditional questions, what? All these three things I distinguished have broader and narrower interpretation. But I think it would have been advisable to have said perfectly plainly what I now believe, that some epistemological questions maybe can be answered a priori. I don't want to say a priori that there aren't such questions. That some may be answerable in part by the sciences of cognition. And that some of them may very well turn out to have been misconceived. Well, sure, some of them may turn out to have been misconceived. And some of them might be best just dumped, but some of them might be best replaced by questions in the sciences of cognition. Sure. But the focus here is on the concept of belief. And part of the reason for this is, well, there are lots of reasons for this, but part of the reason is that Quine and Stitch and Churchill all suggest as one reason for a kind of revolutionary naturalism that abandons the traditional epistemological project in favor of scientific ones, skepticism about the very concept of belief. However, they agree that far, but they don't agree about, I know what it is. I call them atheists, because they don't believe in belief. And also, in part, because you can distinguish between Catholic atheists and Protestant atheists. Common thing. So I can distinguish between extensionalist atheism, which is one of Quine's positions, functionalist atheism, which is the position of his early times like Stitch, and smooth reductionist atheism, which is the Churchman position. These are basically what they're thinking about, what belief would have to be before they would believe it. Now, there's a heroic way with all this, which I'm not going to take. The heroic way is the Popperian way. Popper would say, Forget it. Why do we need all this psychological stuff? It only makes epistemology subjective anyway. Let's simply kick out the knowing subject, look only at the relations among the propositions involved. Let's do epistemology without a knowing subject. Not only do I not believe that's well motivated, I found myself recently in independent science suggesting an account of warrant which begins with the personal, proceeds to build on that a social conception, and proceeds from there to develop an impersonal conception, which is exactly and precisely Popper off his head. So I've got to face the questions about belief. I can't simply set them aside. I've got to deal with it somehow. Okay, so this is where it gets less familiar. What is a belief? My first stab would say, well, okay, I think something else I should say. I've made myself conscious by the last paper yesterday. Agreeably so, I'm later. I'm not trying to give a definition of belief in the unnecessary and sufficient conditions. I'm not interested in that. I don't know how, and I don't care. What I'm trying to do is to offer what I think of as an account of belief, that's to say, to build up a story about what it is to believe something. And I'm sort of building it out layer by layer. So I was tempted to say this has three layers. Something dispositional, something neurophysiological, and something socio-historical. Another face and a bit more history. The idea of belief as a habit of action, which is crucial to person, first derived from the old Scottish psychologist Alexander Bain, whom in this context he describes as the grandfather of pragmatism. I want to add to what I know about what Bain had to say about this, an insight of H.H. Christ. That was the best picture I could find, but I kind of liked it. But belief is not a simple disposition, it's a multiform disposition, is his word. So, take a relatively easy example. There are, of course, much harder ones than this, and I'm going to be cop out a bit and work on the easy one and explain to you that, of course, it will get harder as we move out to different sorts of belief. But suppose somebody believes that snakes are dangerous. What would you expect of them? How would you expect them to behave? What would you expect them to say? Well, I would expect them to shriek at the sight of snakes and run away. To assert or to assent to sentences in whatever language or languages he's familiar with, to the effect that snakes are dangerous. And this is an insight of crisis, and I think it's important. To be startled, to be surprised if he sees someone, say, stroking his pet snake, or handling snakes in a religious ceremony, or whatever. I wish I'd added to this slide, but at the time I said it to Conrad, and it was too late. I wish I'd added. Yes, and to feel some sort of sense of conviction when he entertains the proposition that snakes are dangerous. I know it's unfashionable to talk about feelings of surprise or conviction, but I actually want to include them. And it was only after I'd made this slide that I realized that I don't know if it's my subconscious at work, or if it's simply that Peirce's theory of categories is correct. But if you look at this, you've got feelings of surprise and of conviction. That would be firstness in Peirce's categorization. Reactions to things, which would be secondness in Peirce's theory, and a semiotic relation, a semiotic triadic relation to sentences and things in the world, which would be thirdness in Peirce's account. I think I may have discovered another instance where this theory is helpful. If this were a different sort of talk to a different sort of audience, it would have been about that. Of course, I used the word normally, and I used the word normally on purpose. That was no accident, because this is a relatively simple, straightforward example. And of course, what I said is disguising a whole lot of quite serious problems. For one thing, it's way too atomistic. It disguises all the issues about the interrelations among beliefs. And for another, it presupposes perfectly ordinary and straightforward desires on the part of the person concerned. But if, for example, you're dealing with somebody who thinks that it's what he wants is to manifest his faith in God by handling dangerous snakes as instructed in wherever it says it in the Bible, I don't know what these people are appealing to, but I take it as supposed to be a manifestation of faith, then is not shrieking and running away, but handling things might be compatible with a belief that the snakes are dangerous. All right, still, though it's needs a lot of work. I'm waving my hands about it. It needs a lot of work. The degree, what are the degree of belief? What about the firmness of belief? I think, first of all, these are different things. You can believe something very strongly, but quite unstably. You can believe it to a high degree, and yet, if certain sorts of evidence came in, or if something, certain other kinds of things happened, you would drop it very quickly. So I want to understand degree of belief, degree of credence, strength of belief, as corresponding to the strength of the dispositions concerned, and that will be a matter of how easily they're overridden. Whereas firmness of belief corresponds to how hard it is to change the disposition. Second layer. I don't believe in spooks. I don't believe in ghosts or souls or any of that stuff. This is the metaphysical naturalism I was talking about. So I think it's all physical. All of this is somehow or other realized. And I take it in human beings, it's neurophysiologically realized in some way that I certainly don't know, and that I'm not sure anybody does. But I take it that this, this is an idea that makes some people shriek at me. So I probably better do it slowly, right? So you have plenty of shrieking time if you want to shriek. I know that there's a way of looking at this as if what was required for you to have the belief, say, that Carnap had an aunt who lived in Vienna is sort of on the analogy of there's something about the DNA of this fruit fly that explains why it's got cinnabar eyes and not some other colour eyes. I think that's a completely wrong way of looking at it. That it's not about the characteristics of the gunk in the brain. Now I have to say, of course, I don't think our brains could be made of absolutely anything. Our brains could not be made of butter. They could not be made of brass. Why not? Well, because those are the wrong kinds of stuff to set up the kinds of interconnections that I think constitute the neurophysiological realizations of belief sets. So I think of it, I'm trying to do this in a way which is, it's concerned with human beings, though I'm entirely prepared to acknowledge that there might be three negative G.H. Wells type creatures who also have belief, but I don't think about them. So I'm thinking about our neurophysiology, but I'm trying not to be too specific because I don't want to give hostages to any current neurophysiological speculation. I think the crucial thing from my point of view is that what's going on is something like interconnections between whatever registers input from the world, so whatever hears words and sees things, basically, and whatever activates behavior, whether verbal or non-verbal. So whatever those physiological things are, and our brains must be made of something which is capable of sustaining this, it's connections among those kinds of things which constitute the neurophysiological realizations according to me. However, here is the fourth phase, perhaps the fourth not very familiar phase. And the next shriek-inducing thought. I don't think that the content of beliefs is determined by the physical features of their realizations. I think it's determined by their connections to the world and to the use of the words concerned in the subject linguistic community. And here my inspiration is George Herbert Mead, whom social psychologists sometimes describe as the founding father of their disciplines, and who I think wrote some of the most remarkable stuff on the philosophy of mind that I've ever read. He does have one very serious disadvantage, I should tell you. He writes like a constipated camel. It's really bad. And he's not terribly precise. I think, in fact, I would say he's just, to his great misfortune, just below the level of rigor of writing that is tolerable to an analytic philosopher. You have to sort of say, okay, all right, okay, he doesn't write like I'm used to. Well, okay, I'm going to put up with it because he has all sorts of interesting ideas. Far and away, his most readable book, by the way, is called Mind, Self, and Society, and he didn't write it. These are lecture notes written by his students. They did, however, put the title the wrong way around. It should really be Society, Self, and Mind, as you will see in a minute. The question that we ask, which I think is a deeply interesting question, is, which, after all, like all the pragmatist philosophers, strongly influenced by God. And he begins by asking, okay, so we are, humans are animals. We can no longer talk about men unlike brutes, in the wonderfully politically incorrect way that Hobbes talked about, men unlike brutes. And of course, in many, many ways, we share characteristics with other animals. But on the other hand, there are clearly things that we can do that other animals can't. So what we need to understand, first of all, is how are we like other animals? How are we different? And how does the human capacity for language arise out of this animal ancestry? How could we understand how this could have come about? His account is in terms of language of gestures, and as in, for example, a dog fight. I'm taking from Mead the insight that mindedness depends on social and specifically on linguistic interactions. And I think that's an insight that he didn't have any sort of empirical verification of, but it seems to me that we now do have some. I hate relying on this kind of thing, but okay, this is how I learned about it. Because this is how I learned about it, it's not the kind of thing I can put in a footnote, but it is something I can tell you. I was once stuck in a pretty grim hotel room in Davis, California, with nothing to do for the evening except to turn on the television and see if I could find what I could live with. So I always described Davis to me as a one-horse town with a horse neck. very unfair. But I turned on the television and what did I get? The most fascinating program about a young woman who'd been discovered at the age of, I think, 15. She'd done something naughty when she was very small. And her horrible parents had tied her to her potty chair, stuck her in a room, and ignored her except for passing in food and cleaning her up from time to time. Simply ignored her. And you would have said, when you saw the film of Jeannie when she was first discovered, this is a severely retarded person. After years of intensive work by psychologists, treating her like a much smaller child, and engaging in the sort of linguistic teaching interaction in which one engages with small children, she never really apparently learned to speak quite fluently, but it was perfectly clear that she became minded in exactly the way that we used to. And I think my idea that the content of belief depends on the sociolinguistic, socio-historico-linguistico factors is in the spirit of this insight of Mead. I once had a student who tried to find this movie for me, because the snag about the hotel room in Davis is no video record. Had I been at home, I would have pressed the button immediately. He tried looking it up. I think he must have used the wrong search terms. He looked up Jeannie tied to a chair. And there were all sorts of porn sites and nothing published. So if anyone knows how to find this, please tell me. I take it that there are different physical realizations of the belief that be, maybe, in an English speaker and in a Russian speaker, say, because one of them involves dispositions to respond to English sentences, and the other involves dispositions to respond to Russian sentences. And that would be a question. What makes both of their beliefs the belief that be? I would say, well, because of the parallels in nonverbal behavior and of the similarity of meaning of the relevant English and Russian sentences. I've said similarity very deliberately, not synonymy or sameness. This is, first of all, I conceive of a language. This is very, this is relatively recent and very unfamiliar and makes me very nervous, but what the heck. I think of a language now as a big federation, probably somewhat gerrymandered, of similar enough idioms. Not as something that you can, as it were, not like a rug that you can roll up and put under your arm and take out and study, but as something that's sort of inherently like a fitted carpet nailed down to the linguistic community's concern. And I think now of similarity of meaning across languages, or for that matter within a language, as a matter of degree. And how much similarity we need to attribute the same belief, I take to be context dependent. Mostly, you know, it's similar enough, that's good enough. If you're talking in deep logical questions, that's not good enough, and you're going to need to discriminate more finely. But I don't think there is any simple answer to it. What's the right way to individuate beliefs? I think the answer is it depends what you're trying to do. Because of this idea I have about what the content depends on and going through the sociolinguistic historical loop, I say in defending science, and I stand by it, it's all physical, all right, but it's not all physics. You can call it anomalous monism if you like, but that's not how I arrive. I actually arrived at it part by thinking about alarm clocks. Alarm clocks are certainly physical. All alarm clocks, wherever they are, physical objects of some kind or other. And their working is in accordance with physical law. Something to do with the cogs and the wheels and the bell, or with the electrical contacts and the buzzer or whatever. Nevertheless, if you say of my alarm clock, it's set to go off at 7:30 a.m., that can't be reduced to physics. Similarly, all the goings on in my head are physical. They're all in accordance with physical laws. They have causal relations. I should come to that when I get to talk about inference. But nevertheless, you can't exhaust what's going on by talking vocabulary. Okay, now, I've got a list here. The reason being that my slides are not perfect from here on. They weren't perfect up to here, but they're less perfect from here on. So, to keep myself honest, I made a list of things that I want to say something about. And there are two here that there's no slide about, so let me just mutter about those for a moment. Insincere assertion. What's that? It's very tempting to say, well, it's assertion minus belief, but now we're in danger of going around in too small a circle. I want to say, insincere assertion is assertion which is, first of all, not accompanied by the appropriate non-verbal dispositions. And secondly, which tends to be extremely selective with respect to your audience. My paradigm of the insincere assertion would be the man who asserts with great confidence, great apparent confidence, that the ice is thick enough to bear the weight of a human being walking across, and then encourages his enemy to get to the other side of the lake by walking across, but himself takes the long way round on dry land. What about, this is just shorthand for me, Now you know what I read on airplanes. What about that detective story, Claude? Very common. Completely understandable. We all know that it works and why it works. You suspect X of committing the crime. You don't have a colorable case against him at the moment. You trick him into giving you such a case by leading him to believe that there is evidence of the crime that will link it to him to be found in such and such a place, and that you're about to go get it tomorrow. And then you follow him tonight as he goes to destroy this evidence. Okay, now what's going on there? This story ought to help us understand what's going on. Well, I take it what you do is, first of all, induce in him the belief that there is incriminating evidence in such and such a place, which the police won't get to until tomorrow morning. On the assumption that he has perfectly normal desires, like not to be convicted of a crime, you anticipate that setting up this disposition in him will lead him to behave as a person who believes that and wants this would behave, namely to go and try to destroy the evidence. And then you trap it. And now I get to the bit about babies and dogs and babies. Some people would say I'm unfair to dogs and babies. I think I'm exactly fair to dogs and babies. What about animals and pre-linguistic children? Do they have beliefs? I would say, no, not in the fullest sense they don't, because they will have non-verbal dispositions of the appropriate kind, sure. But they will not have verbal dispositions of the appropriate kind. However, this is not a completely unkind idea. First of all, I'm setting aside, but not setting aside as closed, the question of whether any animals have any kind of linguistic capacity. And insofar as any animals do, then I have to modify what I just said. And secondly, I'm inclined to say that small children gradually begin to have beliefs as they gradually acquire the kinds of linguistic competence that the rest of us grown-ups have. I don't know, I can't tell you exactly when a small, I want to say, okay, now this child really does have beliefs. But I can make a rough stab. Little Tonya is a really interesting character. Probably only some of you have ever heard of the McMartin preschool case. It's a criminal case from California in the 1980s. It was, in its day, the longest running and the most expensive criminal case in the entire history of the United States. That's how important it was. It was a case where the teachers at a preschool, the Martin preschool, were accused of the most bizarre kinds of sexual abuse of the kids in there. On the basis of the testimony of the little kids, I should probably tell you how it turned out, everybody was acquitted. Everybody was acquitted. Everybody was ruined. It's a terrible story. All those teachers' lives were ruined. But I once read, because I'm interested in this kind of elicitation of testimony by psychologists, I once read the transcripts of the interviews with the little children by the psychologists who were trying to make the case for the prosecution. And little Tonya was the most obstinate and the most revealing of the little kids. About four, she was. And the psychologist was desperately trying to get some accusation out of her. It was horrific to see how he was leading her. Trying to get her to say that she'd been abused in some way or other. And so he wasn't getting anything out of her. Nothing. And in the end, in some impatience, the psychologist says, Tonya, do you know what a lie is? It's like, Tonya, do you know what the difference is between the truth and a lie? And Tonya goes, okay, look, Tonya, do you know what a lie is? And she brightens up and says, it has big teeth and it's sort of brownish. She doesn't know the difference between a lie and a liar. I'm inclined to say that at the point at which she does know the difference between a lie and a liar, definitely I want to say she has full beliefs. Before she does, I'm very reluctant to say that. It's the best example I've ever seen of how this goes. What about Mrs. T, who's a character in Stitches from Folk Psychology and Cognitive Science? I believe she was his cleaning lady. It was very unkind about claims that if you asked her, is President McKinley alive or dead? She would say confidently, dead. And if you then said, Mrs. T, are you alive or dead? She would say, I don't know. And Stitch concludes from his description of Mrs. T's terrible mental state, which is part of his argument why nobody believes anything. Well, what I want to say about Mrs. T is, it appears that she was suffering from Alzheimer's or some similar disease. I take it that as a result of this disease, the connections, which I take to be the neurophysiological realizations of belief, in her brain were gradually failing. They were clogging up with plaque or whatever it is that happens to her. But of course, it's absolutely nuts to conclude from this, as Stitch does, that nobody believes anything. Most of us, luckily, are not. So, clogged up. What about disposition to be surprised if it turns out that not here? Well, I take it that a recalcitrant experience is a nice word, I think it probably means work, interrupts some standing multiform disposition. And I think that, in general, having a habit is a lot more comfortable than not having a habit. You see what I mean? Habitual behavior is more comfortable, requires less thought than behavior you have to consider. I know, I have a good example. I've been using the same handbag for 23 years. It was a birthday present from my husband. We confidently expected it to last for at least a quarter of a century. Wrong. This year it died on me. I was very upset. I had to go buy another. And in the other, nothing is where I think it is. And this is actually terribly uncomfortable. I get all fidgety when I'm looking for something. This was Percy's thought about genuine doubt. Genuine doubt is when genuine belief is really interrupted, and it's uncomfortable like any interruption of a settled habit. That's what's going on when we're surprised when we get recalcitrant evidence. I think this may also be what's going on with a certain kind of joke. This is now going to intrigue me. Here's the kind of joke I have in mind. Perfect excuse to tell you a joke, right? A priest, a rabbi, and a minister go into a bar. And the bartender says, is this a joke? Okay. Now, why is that funny? Well, it's because you expect that there's going to be some long and what you get is this totally unexpected thing. And I think somehow the same thing that makes us laugh is the same thing that makes us uncomfortable when a belief is unsettled is what makes us laugh at a joke like that. I have no theory about jokes, but this seems to explain that kind of joke rather much. I know you're probably not familiar with all of you are familiar with the limerick, but there's a lovely one that illustrates the same phenomenon. There was a young man, Tralee, who was stung in the neck by a wasp. They asked if it hurt. He said, no, not a bit, it can do it again if it hurts. Okay, the same failure of expectation is what makes that fun. She, of course, was stung in the neck by a bee. What about introspection? What about access to one's own beliefs? Well, first thing I want to say about that is I think introspection is very fun, very important. We're not that good at it. It's not we can't do it at all, but we're not perfect at it. We can be mistaken about what we believe or about other mental states about sometimes I tell them, my husband says, you're upset, what are you upset about? I say, I'm not upset. He says, sure you're upset. And sooner or later it turns out, he's right, I'm wrong. You know, okay, it's not meant to be a stand-up comedy show, but there's a really, really good joke about two behaviorists who meet on the street. Hi, you're fine, how am I? There's something in that, because you can sometimes tell from somebody else's behavior how they are in a way that is not so readily accessible to them. But I think introspection is also a matter of, I think this is related to what Taylor was talking about, but I can't tie it tightly yet. You're doing something like asking yourself, what would I say or what would I do if such and such? And I think that's something like the sort of imaginative rehearsal that sportsmen will go through in practicing the golf swing without actually touching the club or the ball or anything. And a bit like what you do when you have a suspect you've got a tooth that's not quite right, and you just barely touch it to see what would happen, not to make yourself free. It's something like that. You sort of ever so lightly twang the one thing to see whether you can, as it were, feel the very quiet twanging of the one that's connected to it, if you have this belief. I'm sorry, that was not analytic philosophy, that was phaneroscopy in the Percy style. Some more questions. Well, they're sure about them. I need to say something about them. What exactly is inference? Well, first of all, there's something causal going on. If I infer P from Q, then I take it, one multiform disposition somehow causally triggers the other. But if I want to say that inference is a valid one, I'm saying something about the content of the two. So I'm skipping to the other level. What exactly a current belief is, I find quite puzzling. I think I overstated it when I said it's not an activated belief disposition. That might be one kind of current belief. But another kind is that feeling of conviction when you consider the proposition. And I think what I'm trying to say about that is you, as it were, say in your head, P, not P, but say to nature, whatever it is, and you sense that you have a disposition to assert it or to extend to it. So it's the twanging one end to see what happens with the other. What about self-deception? Maybe I should tell you why I started with that. I initially worried about belief because I don't see how to do epistemology without beliefs. I'm worried about it some more in defending science because I don't see how to do social science without attributing beliefs to people. Indeed, one of my rude remarks about Churchland long ago, as 1993 was, if he really doesn't believe that anybody believes anything, I don't understand how he ever dares to get into a car. Why on earth would you get into a car and drive around if you didn't believe that other people believed that if they banged into you, it was potentially damaging to them? Now I'm also, I've been writing some stuff about intellectual integrity and honesty and such. I'm concerned about self-deception. Who's that possibly? What's going on? Well, I think Cardinal Newman has something very interesting to say about that. It's not in human nature to deceive others for any long time without in a measure deceiving ourselves. True. I've known people about whom I find Newman's remark extremely illuminating. Like a dishonest real estate agent, a dishonest chair of the department, of whom I was initially inclined to say, this guy's just a pathological liar. They just say things they know are not true over and over. No, it's not true. After a little while, I'm going to say, no, that's not right. This person would probably pass a lie detector test. What's really going on is they don't believe anything. Well, that's one of the subjects on which I thought pathologically lie. They don't really have beliefs. Why? Well, because they've been deceiving others for so long. But what used to be a straightforward disposition that they were ignoring when they spoke in sincerity, or overriding when they spoke in sincerity, has just got messed up. So I think one way to deceive yourself is systematically to behave as if you believe the thing. I guess there's a skeptical thought about Pascal's wager somewhere. As a result of which, I think, the relevant dispositions sometimes come to be automated. You do it often enough, it gets to be habitual. But then the old dispositions, the ones that you were overriding in the first place, are still there. So that you're in this funny, ambivalent condition. You'll notice, I think, that this picture of self-deception, it doesn't cover every case, because not every self-deceiver starts by deceiving other people on this matter. Some self-deceivers simply keep saying to themselves, you know, I'm the best, I'm the best, I'm the best, or whatever it is that you say to yourself, or I'm going to win the lottery, I'm going to win. No, or no, no, this little spot isn't sinister, it isn't sinister, it isn't sinister. In effect, they do to themselves what this kind of self-deceiver does first to other people, and then finds he has done to himself. Okay, well, I wasn't keeping a very close watch on the time, but I think I'm about.
Good questions.
Your discussion of different languages. I think to some extent it goes to different linguistic subcommunities, and I think my dissertation was on Kuhnian incrementability and paradigm change and things like that. And these scientists supposedly can be saying, using the same words to say quite different things, because there's all this underlying practical aspects of how they interact with the world that Pliny calls tacit knowledge. I think my own personal opinion is that virtually everything we say has a huge component of tacit knowledge, and some of it can be quite individualistic or belong to very small subgroups. Mm-hmm. And we're remarkably good at picking out where somebody's coming from, so to speak. And I was wondering how that would fit into your view.
Okay. Well, let me start with the beginning. I now think of a language, as I said, as a sort of gerrymandered federation of sufficiently similar idioms. If the sort of word that we use ordinarily to refer to a language, English, Polish, French, whatever, is actually really quite true. I recently read a book about the recent evolution of English as it's spoken in Singapore, Singlish, they call it, in Hong Kong, in India, and so on. And it's very clear that what we call English is actually a gerrymandered federation of sub languages, and I think each of those is a gerrymandered federation of idiolects. And I think that probably no two people have exactly the same idiolect. This is just an instance if you told me 10 years ago I would be thinking about ethics, I would have laughed at you. And if you told me 10 years ago I would be reading Nietzsche, I would have laughed at you. But Nietzsche says something very, very interesting in his paper on Schopenhauer, about how everyone knows in their heart that they will never. never be anybody exactly like that. But everybody's intellect is formed by a very specific. So I didn't think about language in roughly the same way. There are all sorts of interconnections, and they would be different for different people. Now, what about incommensurability? The first thing I want to say is, I guess it's a very simple, logical point, but I'd like it on the table so that there's no clarity. From the fact that this term, in theory T, has a different meaning from the same term, in theory T prime, it does not follow that T and T prime don't contradict each other. Because it doesn't follow from the fact that this term doesn't have the same meaning, but no sentence of this theory contradicts any sentence of that theory. So I think that there was already considerable slippage from the meaning variance idea, right, to the incommensurability idea. Now, as to incommensurability itself, what I want to say is that there's a real phenomenon, but it's a curious kind of epistemological illusion. There is a phenomenon, there's a real phenomenon, which is misunderstood. That's what I mean by the epistemological illusion. What's the real phenomenon? The real phenomenon is that what's relevant to what, in particular, what evidence is relevant to what theory, is not a purely logical matter, it's not an entirely syntactically characterizable matter. It depends in part on the context. And in consequence, what you believe is relevant to what depends on what other things you believe. Okay. You can be the sensible person and I'll be the idiot. Suppose I believe the character can be determined by handwriting, and you don't. And that we're together interviewing somebody for a position, say, as secretary of the department. Now, I may say, look, for heaven's sake, don't hire her. Because I, of course, would have insisted they all submit a handwritten letter of application. You would have said this is a total waste of time, but I've overridden you. I look at X's application and say, look how she writes her G's. Would you trust someone like that with a petty cash? No way. Not her. And you think it's completely irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant. Of course it's irrelevant. I agree with you. I would be an idiot for the sake of argument. So we disagree about what evidence is relevant, because we disagree about whether graphology is true. This means that when there is disagreement within a scientific community about whether this theory or maybe there are others is the true one, there will be disagreements about what evidence is relevant, what evidence is most relevant, what experiments you should first perform, and so on, and so on. This is a perfectly genuine phenomenon. It doesn't follow from that that there is no non-paradigm relative, or whatever you want to say, better and worse evidence. That's a sort of illusion. It looks as if there is, if you don't realize that what matters is, what creates the apparent incommensurability is the disagreement in background. And what would resolve it would be the answer to which of them is right. So, in the case that I just invented, the truth is that how this person writes her G's is not relevant to whether she's trustworthy.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's what I see.
What worries me about the work I've done, anyway, for your whole account, which I find a little bit heavy on the language side, is that a lot of this background knowledge is not articulated, and consequently people couldn't express it if they had to. It is possible to. You can learn to. That's my argument anyway. It has more to do with how we use words and how we put them into application rather than the meanings of words or the concepts that we have. That's my worry.
I'm not sure why you're worried.
Well, maybe I shouldn't be.
Maybe you shouldn't be. Let me just press it a little bit further. You will have noticed that there was implicit in what I said a sort of response, a response to Quine, but not a required, a reply to Quine. That's to say, his extensionist atheism. That's to say, a kind of acknowledgement, in a way he's right about me, the idea that there were clean, sharp, attributable meanings to chunks of language. I think he was right, that's a mistake. But I think he was wrong to imagine that this meant that we couldn't attribute beliefs well enough for whatever the particular purposes at hand were. I think whether or not we have a real disagreement probably depends on whether you want to say that the tacit knowledge involved is simply unarticulated, or whether you want to go so far as to say that in principle, no matter how hard tried to elicit it, it's inarticulate.
Oh no, I definitely.
If you wanted to say that, then we really would disagree.
Yeah, no, I definitely disagree with that. Okay. That's what my thesis was about.
So. Okay. Okay.
No, so apparently I agree with you. Okay.
Okay.
I love your Federation view of language, but isn't the Federation too narrow? Well, it reminds me a little bit of this philosophy of language tendency to overvalue language, which comes to the forefront especially with Davidson's view of thinking animals. You know, it's definitely going too far that way. Talking about feral humans, which is really what you touched upon, what about the humans raised by the llama, there is this story, or the dogs, etc., who actually acquire communication, so there is semantics there, with the dogs or with whatever raised them. And so they do have that semiotics, they do have thinking. But when we go back to suddenly requiring them to use our language, they fail badly. We will fail badly among the dogs. So I think we are kind of too homocentric in the wrong way. If we want to learn the semiotics of the dolphins or even of the bees, suddenly we would be in trouble. That's my first little question. The second is, Potter, what do you think of Tom Nagel's idea that the best folkloristic hypothesis is that we know 20% of what there is to know, not 99%? That changes the map a lot, to the point that, although I agree with you that most things we would ever, or everything we would ever discover would be understood by the scientific method as you nicely and broadly defined. However, there might be parts of the picture that are on a completely different world than what we know, which today might be better explained by some sort of even religion, you know, Buddhist or otherwise, than by our contemporary science, just because our science is too narrow, which is kind of why, you know, whatever Newton studied, not chemistry, but, you know, what was it, Sampara science, because it was closer to the contemporary chemistry than anything available at this time, yes?
Okay, to the first question. I think it's not federation that's the problem. It's language. I'm actually inclined to agree with you that I spoke in terms of language and linguistics. Learning and so on, that it might be a better and more accurate story if one were to generalize it to include sign use that was not in quite the sense that I was using it linguistic. The main reason I didn't do that is because I don't know how. I'm inclined to say that certainly other animals besides human beings are sign-using, but explaining exactly what that amounts to is very tricky. I don't know how to do it. I would continue to insist on, as it were, first of all, the triadic nature of the relation concerned between sign, the person, and the world. Okay. And I would certainly want to resist going so far as, you know, phytosemiology or whatever it is, phytosemiotic. Because morning glories do respond to the sun. I don't want to go that far. Remind me what the second question was. Beyond science. Okay.
I mean, 20% is good.
Okay. When I first heard you say that, I wanted to say, I think he's way too optimistic. Way too optimistic. Seriously, after I've said that, the next thing I want to say is, of course, we don't really have ways of measuring this. That's the first thing.
That's why I said it was proof of hypothesis.
There's no counting propositions. It's hopeless. You might be able to talk about what we don't know, right, and how something is taken out of that list, but you have to do it from that end. Seriously, though, I think we need to talk about the limits of science. Sometimes religious people say, sometimes they say to me, in a very distinctive tone of voice, can science explain everything? And the idea is, if you say no, they got you. I believe without any hesitation, I would say that the answer to that is no. There are many things. There are many things, of course, that they can't explain now. Forget that. There are also many things, not only that they can't explain now, but there are questions they can't even ask now because they haven't got the vocabulary yet. Think, for example, I actually don't know how to pronounce this word. I've only ever read it, so correct me if I get it wrong. Prions, is it, or prions? Those badly folded molecules in the brain that are responsible for mad cow disease.
Prions,
okay. Until we had that concept, there were a whole bunch of questions you couldn't even ask, let alone ask. But there are also a whole bunch of questions that are simply not within the competence of the sciences. Culinary questions. Some things about cooking are chemistry, but some things are not. Questions about legal concept, legal history. These are empirical questions, but they're not questions for any of the sciences. Many questions of that kind. And then, of course, there are questions such that scientists can't answer them, because the best thing to do with those questions is turn them aside. I remember in the aftermath of Hurricane Andrew, some people in Florida were asking, in all seriousness, why did the hurricane hit our church and not yours? The most disturbing thing I saw in the aftermath of that was about a congregation in one church thanking God that their church had been saved while the other one had been hit. Why was my cow hit by lightning and not yours? Sorry, it's a coincidence. There's nothing to tell you. Right? You're looking for an explanation with this of a kind and where there is no explanation to be had. So, on the one hand, I guess I'm with you, insofar as I want to say, there are many questions beyond the reach of science. But perhaps I'm not, because I don't include in all those questions questions about the supposed otherworldly stuff that religions talk about. Okay, so I'm giving you half a confession and being more pessimistic than maybe. I think that what we don't know is just, we have no conception of what we don't know.
One point in your attitude made me really unhappy. You define this category of full belief, and I think this is extremely misleading category, because the detriment is whether the belief is well defined or ill defined, and the proportion between verbalized part and behavioral. That is so much better for epistemological considerations. For instance, I certainly know how you look like, so I can identify you easily in any group. And this is a sort of belief which is well defined in my case. And this is not a belief I can verbalize. I am not able to, because I have no ability to describe people's look. And that's matter in every epistemological consideration, process of learning or gaining knowledge is based, you know, on this firm belief in the sense that they are well defined, not in the sense that they are full, that we can express them in a verbal way.
Okay, I'm going to give you a partial. Session, I guess. Look, epistemology in the last century was extremely tightly focused, I think, on knowledge that came. Right? It's clear that, though it's profoundly interesting, I'm not apologizing for having been interested in that area. It's interesting in part because it's where scientific knowledge belongs, for example. I should say something about myself. It seems to me an awful lot of people in philosophy. They're interested in this question. Call it Q. And somehow or other, you get this whole kerfuffle about Q is not just the question that I'm interested in. It's the most important and interesting question that there is in this area, or that there is in philosophy or something. I don't take that view at all. I pick on the ones that I think I can do something with and that are not of trivial interest. My choosing to work on one question doesn't mean that I'm in any way inclined to denigrate others, right? Which was why part of my reply to you is, I have been interested in, I've been writing about the philosophy of science, but that doesn't mean that I think that science can explain everything. Now, there are other important, cognitive things we can do, like recognize. And I would acknowledge without any reservation that nothing I've said here has much to do with any of that. Okay. And I do think that where the narrower thing that I have been concerned with is concerned, the notion of whether the concept of belief applies in the full sense or not, that's important. Okay, so I'm giving you one concession, but keeping something for myself. I think I'll try to get your attention from mine.
We have time for only one very short question, and there are lots of questions that who has the shortest one?
How do we know who that is?
Introspection is fallible, so just I'll pay by random.
So we've got several different ways we can talk about the degree of belief. Earlier in the talk, we distinguished degree of belief from degree of firmness of belief. But now I think you also made it clear, speaking of developmental aspects of belief, that we can, in some sense, talk about the degree of capacity for belief. Right? Am I okay with that?
Well, I would say. Every normal human child has the capacity in full from the beginning,
okay.
But it's not actualized unless and until.
Correct. So I'm just wondering if that sense of degree is actually also applicable to people for example, adults who have well-developed verbal capacities, but constrained to areas. Like, for example, I would like to say that I don't really have capacities for beliefs about string theory. I just don't.
Yes.
And then, so you see where I'm going with that. So then I'm wondering if there's any insight there, any value to that observation might be used as a way of understanding why, for example, we can be doubtful whether we believe we have beliefs. In other words, when we get to the area of philosophy, I'm not really even sure what I'm asserting there. I'm not sure that I have beliefs about beliefs. I'm not sure it translates into any really clear nonverbal behavior.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I guess the first thing to say is that this is a problem you said this to Richard too. I'm not sure full belief was a terribly happy choice of words. Now I reconsider it. Thank you. Because a degree of belief is degree of strength of belief. So that the assumption is you have the belief that P, but sort of kind of. You're absolutely confident. Degree of firmness of belief is once again you have the belief. But the question is, would this be enough to stop you, or would it take an earthquake to change that disposition? Okay. Whereas when I was talking about animals not having beliefs in the full sense, it was the sense of belief that was full, or not the belief, but the sense of belief. You're asking about capacity. I think not a perfectly clear notion except at the edges, which is why I first gave you a very edgy answer. Every normal human child has the capacity for belief at birth, but this capacity is not actualized unless and until it undergoes a reasonably normal sort of socialization process. But of course, it may be that in some slightly weaker but also slightly more realistic sense of capacity, in a slightly more real world sense, not every normal human being has the capacity to form beliefs about certain subject matters because they may just be incapable of understanding them to such a degree that they can form a belief at all. I'm very sympathetic to that thought in part because the first time I read Richard Jeffries' book, I can't remember its title, The Probability of Bayesian. First time I read it, I actually thought I'd discovered a hole in my head. There was stuff in it I simply could not understand. I could not get my brain around it. I eventually discovered, I believe, that the ambiguity there was just tripping me up every time. And once I cleared it up, it wasn't my head. But I got the sense of what it might be like to be simply unable to grasp something. You just can't get it. That's a weaker sense of capacity, is really what I want to say. And I'm not sure. Okay, here's what I'm thinking. It's the Nietzsche thought again. That every child is born with this capacity. come to fruition if they have some sort of relatively normal upbringing. But as you live your life, you will focus on certain sorts of topic and question and whatnot. And as you do that, because our attention and our brain power is limited, in some sense your capacity for forming beliefs about other things will drop. I've been made conscious lately, for example, when colleagues or visitors to my law school read enormously complex papers about, you know, the legal history of this or that constitutional concept. So I get the sense of, damn it, I am never really going to understand this. But I don't get the sense of that there's something wrong with my head. I just get the sense of the problem is that I would have to do this for as long as they have been doing it before I could do it as fluently as they do. And there isn't time left for me to do that, which is a different sort of incapacity. You see what I mean? So there may be inherent incapacities and learning related incapacities because you spend the time on something else and there simply isn't enough time to get through it. As you get older, the horizon of time gets shorter. And I'm actually reasonably confident that I could do what they do, like they do, if I had another 40 years. But I probably shan't be doing it for another 40 years. So.
Thank you.
This talk has been brought to you by the Center for Philosophical Research, Warsaw, Poland. For more talks, check our webpage at www.obf.edu.pl.